Welcome to the Project Zion podcast. This podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts the Restoration offers for today's world. We aim to feature a variety of guests with roots in the Restoration tradition from Community of Christ and our friends from The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The music has been provided by Ben Howington. You can find his music at mormonguitar.com.
Welcome to another episode of the Project Zion podcast. I'm your host, Katie Langston, and I am just delighted to be here today with a wonderful guest who has so graciously agreed to come on and share her story. And we're very excited to have Gail Humphrey on the podcast today. Hello, Gail. Welcome to Project Zion.
Hi. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Oh, well, thank you for being here. Why don't you take just a moment and sort of introduce yourself? I mean, we'll dive deep into your story, but kind of just introduce yourself to our listeners so that they have a chance to kind of know your name and who you are.
Okay. I am 59 years old at this point. I've been married for 38 years to Joyce Humphrey. We have six children together. The oldest is 29 years old, and the youngest is almost 17. We live in the San Francisco Bay Area, and I am a registered nurse working at Stanford University Hospital in the Palliative Care Medicine Clinic. I've been a member of the Community of Christ Church all of my life, with a brief 25-year hiatus as I tried to figure things out and come to terms with things. So had quite a life so far.
It sounds like it, and I can't wait to get to hear more about it. So why don't we just go right to the beginning? And you say you were raised in the RLDS Church. Why don't you talk a bit about your growing up and your childhood? Where did you grow up? And specifically talk a little bit about your religious upbringing and sort of the beginning of your story.
Okay. My dad was in the United States Air Force, so we traveled a lot. I think by the time I was 18 years old, we had moved, I believe my mom told me at one point, 34 times in my first 18 years.
Wow.
I wasn't always, we didn't always go to church. My dad had been raised in the church, and my grandparents, especially my grandmother on my dad's side, was very active in the RLDS Church. But when my dad turned 18, I think he kind of left the church for a period of time. And it wasn't until I was about 4 years old that we returned to the church, which is kind of an interesting story, because my dad and mom were what you would call, I guess in the old days, they would call worldly. My dad and mom smoked and drank and, you know, did those kinds of things. And one day, when we lived in Chandler, Arizona, where my dad was stationed in the Air Force, he rolled down the window of the car and he proceeded to, vomit outside the window. And a police officer saw him and pulled him over and gave him a ticket for driving under the influence and arrested him on the spot.
Oh, wow.
My mom let him sit in jail overnight. And the next day when he got out and came home, all the bags were packed, and we were standing by the door, and my mom gave him an ultimatum that said, either you stop drinking or we're leaving. And at that point, as I said, my dad totally stopped consuming alcohol. It was a very short time later on when they were sitting, they told me this story. They were sitting watching TV one night, and they said a voice from the TV said, read section 86 of the Doctrine and Covenants. And my mom said to my dad, what's that book? And what's a section 86? And so my dad said, well, let's look. And so they climbed up into the closet on the top shelf, and they pulled the book down and they read it. Of course, it's the Word of Wisdom in the RLDS Church. And they started living their life based on that, you know, they incorporated Section 86 into their lives. And so I remember very early on when we were little kids, we started going to church there in the Phoenix area. And within about 6 months, my dad was ordained to the office of priest. And then shortly after that, he was called and ordained to the office of elder. And then we were transferred to Ramstein, Germany, where he was stationed, and he became the pastor of the congregation there. Every place we lived, my entire growing up, my dad was always the pastor of every congregation that we attended. And as a matter of fact, when he was stationed at Alamogordo, in Alamogordo, New Mexico, at the Air Force Base there, he was the pastor of two congregations, one in Alamogordo and one in Las Cruces, New Mexico, which were about 80 miles apart. And so one Sunday we would go to Alamogordo, and the next Wednesday night we would go to Las Cruces for prayer meeting, and then the next Sunday Las Cruces for Sunday school or church, and then the following Wednesday back to Alamogordo for prayer meeting. And we did that for an entire year that I can remember.
Wow.
My folks were very, very fundamental, quite the Bible literalist.
Okay.
And that's kind of the environment that I grew up in. I mean, Joyce, my wife, and I grew up in the same era, and we both have talked about this many, many times. We were told things. We were told what to believe. You know, this is what we believe, and, you know, this is what the church says. And Joyce and I both just took it at face value. Okay. You know, and we just believed it without ever questioning anything, you know. And so that's kind of the way we lived our lives.
And so you would say that your upbringing in a sort of fundamentalist way was pretty typical then of the experience of RLDS folks during that time period.
Well, I know that it was in the places that we lived, and a lot of the people that we came in contact with were very much like us. If they weren't like us, they certainly didn't speak up and say it that I can remember.
Sure.
I just don't remember hearing people until I was much older and an adult ever question the theology or the doctrine, you know, that I had been taught as a child. But I remember also having many, many great experiences growing up, you know, things being said to me under the influence of the Spirit by different people, and dreams, and, you know, those kinds of things. And that had a real dramatic impact on me, you know. And I was fortunate that as a child, in all those moves that we had, that, you know, at one point we lived in Europe and traveled all over Europe. And another point we lived in Asia and traveled all over Asia. And so I had a real eclectic understanding of the world. And, it was very rich. I can remember as a, you know, a real young child being 6 or 7 or 8 and going to Dachau as a child. And we were over there just about 12 years, maybe a little bit more than that. I was born in 1957. So I was born 12 years after the war ended.
Mm-hmm.
And then shortly after that, probably about 6 years after that, we were in Germany, and I still saw a lot of the devastation that was there. You know, the bombed out pillboxes and bunkers and buildings were still in ruins. And my folks took us to different battle sites in Europe and took us to Dachau, one of the concentration camps. And I remember as a young child walking through that and seeing that and looking inside the ovens where the bodies were burned and cremated. And it had a real dramatic impact on me. And I think it's part of what has made me, you know, who I am today and my concern about social justice and, you know, those kinds of things and helping out people who are less, valued in the world than other people. And it does mean a lot to me. And I'd like to consider myself a, you know, an advocate for those people. And as a matter of fact, I'm in a group, that is part of that. You know, I'm a transsexual, male to female. I had my surgery probably, in 2008. And, I've lived, you know, now I'm almost 60 years old. I was close to 50 years at the time when I went through all of that.
Wow. So talk a little bit about that. You know, when would you say, was it in your childhood or adolescence that you would say that you began to recognize that perhaps the gender you were assigned wasn't the one that you might have chosen for yourself? And I'm guessing you might not have had that language to describe that at that point, but talk a little bit about your early experiences coming to recognize that something, you know, might be a little different for you.
Okay. I was actually fairly young. I think I was probably somewhere between the age of 4 and 6. I became acutely aware that there was something different. I didn't know how to put it into words. I didn't know how to express it. I didn't tell anybody about it. I didn't know what it was. But I did know that there was something different. I did know that I felt like, I was a female. And, of course, everyone around me, treated me much differently than that. And, so began, you know, for a transsexual, it's hard for people who have never gone through this experience to really understand, you know, what it's like. But in your head and in your heart, you feel one thing and your body says something, you know, totally different. And so you have this mix of feelings that are kind of antagonistic against each other going on all of the time.
Yeah.
You know, you wake up and it's there. You go to bed and it's there. It slaps you in the face every day, multiple times. And, people unknowingly reinforce the stereotypes and encourage the behavior. And if you act outside of that, especially in that time frame, in the late 50s and 60s and all of that, you know, it wasn't acceptable, at least not in my world,
right.
in the group of people that I most often associated with, which were honestly church people. It was not an acceptable thing. I remember being told repeatedly by my folks, you know, as I was growing up, that we are not raising you to be a queer, you know, you know, those kinds of things. And I heard that repeatedly, you know,
Was it something that you would communicate? Like, did you ever communicate it to your parents? I feel like I should be a girl, or was it? I mean, did they just pick up on it and make comments like that to you? Was it acknowledged?
Well, I think it was both actually, Katie.
Okay.
I didn't tell my folks. I told my mom. I never approached my dad with it. I told my mom when I was in the seventh grade. I said, here, I need to sit down and tell you something. And I told her, and she immediately went to my father and told my father.
Oh, man.
And so about when I was, because, I mean, she was, you know, she was doing what she felt was right. And my dad was the head of the house, and she had to report, you know, this thing to the head of the house and, you know, and all of that. So she went and told him, and that began a series of, psychiatrists that I was referred to to make me a normal male. And, I went through a series probably of about, I don't know, three or four, maybe even five different therapists, you know, to try, to become, somebody that would be acceptable to everybody. I just wanted to be so normal.
Oh, you know, I'm sure.
It was just, it was, you know, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, and I know there are a lot of people that would disagree with this, it's not something I chose. And if people think that, you know, that GLBT folk choose this as an alternative lifestyle, I think they're sorely mistaken. It's not something anybody has chosen. And I've talked to a number of transsexuals like me and also gay and lesbian people. And in that time frame, you know, in that period of history, there are many of us that tried to do everything we could to be normal because of the social stigmas and the pressure to be that way. Now, today, it's totally different than it was back then. I mean, you've got kids as early as a year and a half or two that are declaring, you know, that they're not male or female, you know, they're the opposite, and people are understanding they need to embrace that and deal with it and are doing so in a healthy way. So to not, cause problems for their children later on, you know? And it sure would have been a whole lot healthier. If that had been done when I was growing up, but it simply was not the case.
So honestly, go ahead. Well, I was just going to ask, like, some of the therapy that you went to, you know, what was it geared around kind of therapies to get you to change your, you know, to change your self perception and to change your gender identity? Were those, I mean, you hear about, you know, like, homosexual conversion therapy, you know what I, Was it along those lines or?
No, mine wasn't. Fortunately, mine was not like that.
Oh, good.
Mine was more like, and I remember the doctors reporting to my folks. I never actually went very long to any of them because, they wanted my parents' support and my parents' involvement in the therapy, and my father just flat out said, I know more than the therapist does. There's no reason for me to go. And he refused to be a part of it, you know, which really upset me. But, you know, so I think it was more like this is a phase and he'll come out of this phase at some point, you know. And so that was that way. But unfortunately, I do have friends who are transsexuals who have gone through that kind of therapy. There's one, as a matter of fact, who in Omaha, probably within the last 10 or 12 years, had to be, because I didn't know her before then, and she was still going for a period of time, had gone to Omaha at the demand of her partner and had electroshock therapy.
Wow.
And then, and also, the therapist had come on to her and had used her in a sexual way. As part of, you know, I don't know if it was part of his therapy or whatever, but you hear stories like that. And I don't know how how often that kind of thing happens. But yeah. I do have friends that have gone through, you know, that kind of therapy. And, of course they have issues and problems that they have to deal with as a,
oh, for sure.
you know, as a result of all that. But mine was just basically the regular psychotherapy, you know, and mm-hmm. asking questions, listening to your responses and, you know, that kind of thing. So.
Okay. Okay. So this is something that in seventh grade that you brought to your mom and immediately took it to your dad and so began sort of some short-lived rounds of therapy to try and engage your parents in the process, and they weren't super receptive to that, and the therapist sort of had this idea that it was something that would be a phase that would go away in time. And of course I'm guessing, I mean obviously it never quote went away.
No.
Talk a bit about your journey after that point, after you left your parents' house and sort of talk about both your religious trajectory and then also your path with trying to come to terms or build a life despite knowing that you're transgender.
Well, when I graduated from high school, I had a dream of becoming a doctor one day, and my mm-hmm. folks had five of us, you know, that they had raised, and there was no way, even if they were inclined, there was no way that they could help pay for my college.
Mm-hmm.
So I joined the United States Navy at the time, because they had the GI Bill, and I knew mm-hmm. that they would pay for my college once I got out after 4 years, and I became a hospital corpsman, in the United States Navy and served in the Navy from 1975 to 1979.
Wow.
During that time, I had met Joyce earlier when we were in high school. And we went to church at the same place in Anderson, California. My dad okay. taught at Anderson High School after he retired for about one school year for 9 months. And then
okay.
we moved off again, and I didn't see Joyce for 4 or 5 years after that. And we started corresponding while I was in the Navy. And then right after she graduated from high school, we got married in San Diego, California in 1978.
Okay.
We attended the RLDS church there in San Diego, and then I went to college in the Valley at Fresno State and got my bachelor's degree in social work. And the whole time, mm-hmm. Joyce and I were active, just like my folks and her folks had been active. They were, mm-hmm. we were on both sides members of the RLDS church. And, we became just as active as our folks had been.
Mm-hmm.
I preached sermons, I taught classes, I functioned in my priesthood callings. By that time I was a priest in the church, and, mm-hmm. We just became very, very active. I went out on home visits and home ministry, encouraging people to pray and, you know, to do the other things that the priest in the church did then.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we got really active, and we were very fundamental, just as our folks
sure.
had been.
Yeah.
We, as a matter of fact, when we, finished up with school, my folks were living, near, Mojave, California, and we moved down in that area for a period of time. And Joyce and I were reading the Doctrine and Covenants, I think it was, and in one of the sections of the Doctrine and Covenants in the RLDS version, I don't know if it's in the LDS version or not, but
mm-hmm.
it said, unless you've been commanded to tarry, gather to Zion. And I looked at Joyce and I said, Joyce, have we been commanded to tarry? And she said, no. And I said, well, then we need to be moving. We're
wow.
supposed to gather in Zion. And
wow.
so we began then to get ready to go. And through a series of what we took as miraculous events, we made our way back to Independence, Missouri back in 1985. And then lived there. We started attending a congregation called Enoch Hill. Shortly after we got back there, our world fell apart.
Okay.
They started ordaining women in the church. And, I know it sounds funny now, but I'll tell you, I felt like, and I'm pretty sure Joyce did, and there were a lot of others like us.
Yeah.
Who felt like the earth had just shook and had moved underneath our feet, and our equilibrium was all out of kilter. I mean, I just, you know, my whole life was the church.
Yeah.
And such a big change, so radical and so different so quickly, we couldn't handle our fundamental minds, you know, our fundamental outlook on life was just so totally opposed to that. And I think in 1986, Joyce and I, and by that time, all my brothers and sisters and my folks had all moved back to Zion together in. And so we were all back there then, and we all attended the same congregation, and, you know, we all left at the same time and went to the first restoration branch that was started in Independence, Missouri.
Wow.
And I was heavily involved in that organization. I was subsequently ordained to the office of elder there. I was the pastor of different restoration branches, one in particular. We attended about three or four, and over 25 years we just became very disillusioned about what we saw happening. It was like, you know, when the church fell apart in our minds, it was like there were all kinds of splinter groups. And I mean, it was almost like when Joseph Smith was assassinated in 1844, and you had Strang, and you had Al Cutler, and you had all these other people claiming to be the one mighty and strong.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's what happened in our experience in the restoration branch. There were, I don't know how many churches that sprang up from that. You'd have to talk to John Hamer or somebody else who knows better than I do.
Right.
But there were so many groups that sprang up, and they all had apostles, and some of them even had prophets and, you know, and that kind of thing, claiming to be, you know, the organization that was going to bring in Zion.
Right. You know? Wow.
It was wild.
So I'm just so fascinated by this experience and this story that, you know, that you moved to Zion with your family and your parents, and had you told your wife about, you know, about your situation, and your transgender experience, or had you buried that really deep? And how had you reconciled that within yourself at that point?
Well, we've had many discussions about this. I think I told her, a day or two probably after we were married.
Wow.
I was so afraid that she was going to leave me that I told her, right around the time we were married. It was either a day or two before or a day or two after. I don't honestly remember, but she was aware of it. And the first time I told her about it, of course, she sobbed and sobbed and sobbed.
Yeah.
This is not what she signed on for, you know, and she assured me at that point. I mean, I was 21 and she was 18. She assured me at that point that, you know, she would do everything she could to make me happy as a man, and that she couldn't support anything that would, you know, that would be different than that.
Right.
As a matter of fact, it wasn't until probably 20 years later that she finally, and it wasn't really until almost the time that I openly transitioned, she finally said, I can accept you this way, and I see you this way, and I'm sorry that I didn't accept it sooner because, you know, it made me uncomfortable, that kind of thing. And I just, she's an amazing woman. And
she sounds amazing.
You know, she has stood by my side all these years, 38 years now, and still loves me with the same intensity and fervor that she did, you know, when we were first married. I tried, Katie, I really tried
to
be normal. I tried, I prayed, for hours on end.
Mm-hmm.
I studied my scriptures for up to 6 hours a day.
Wow.
I fasted up to 3 days a week. I was administered to, I don't know how many times, asking God to take this away. Take it away from me. I don't want to be like this.
Mm-hmm.
And I cried and I cried and I cried, and it just would not go away.
Mm-hmm.
And when I finally got to the point, and you do things, you know, part of the, just so you'll understand a little bit better, part of the transsexual journey is that you, especially for males to females, I am not a female to male, so I don't know what their journey is like, or if it's similar to mine or other male to female transsexuals. But I know many male to female transsexuals try to do everything that they can, in order to prove to themselves and to others that they are definitely male.
Uh-huh.
So, I know the story of, male to female transsexual who was actually in the UDT SEALs in the United States Navy, which has got to be the biggest, most macho part of the service,
right.
You know, just to prove and prove that.
Right.
And a lot of us went into the service to prove it. Some of us had children, you know, if you're fathering children, certainly you can't be a female, you know, fixing cars or, you know, whatever it is, you do a lot of the stereotypical types of things, trying to get this stuff out of your head, and it just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got to the point where I had been stuffing it for so long that I just loathed myself. I felt like I was living a lie.
Yeah.
I wasn't living openly and honestly with anybody. Yeah. I'd go and preach at church, and I would say, you know, you've got to love God, and the Bible says this, and the Book of Mormon says this, and the Doctrine and Covenant says this, and this is what we should be doing. And I talked against homosexuality and talked against all the GLBT stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all in an effort to try to hide and run from what was going on and the turmoil I was feeling inside of me. And with all of that, I began to loathe myself. I hated myself. And it became very black. My world became very, very black. And I got to the point where, close to the age of 50, I was suicidal. And I said, I'm going to finish it. I can't go on anymore like this. And it was at that point I started seeing a gender therapist in the Kansas City area.
Mm-hmm.
And with her help and with Joyce's help, we made the decision to transition.
Wow.
And I think if I had not made that decision, I would not be here, talking to you today about this.
Wow.
I've heard the estimate is that, you know, by the age of 21, transsexual people, at least 40% have either tried or been successful, in committing suicide.
I've heard that too.
And, yes, and it's a very sad thing, and I'm glad I never did. I'm just so happy that I didn't, because on the other side, I found a real difference, not only physically and socially in my family, but also in my relationship with God. It's totally different today than it was when I was, you know, on the other side.
So let's talk a little bit more about that. So you... you moved to Missouri and then the church drops the bomb and ordains women and throws everything into chaos. And so you kind of go from congregation to congregation, and you become disillusioned, recognizing that, you know, there's something of a schism crisis happening, within the restoration branches. So what happens after that? What do you do religiously and spiritually when you begin to become disillusioned, and around what year was that?
Well, that would have been about 2006 or 2007, when that started to happen. We had gotten to the point where we had tried different restoration branches to find one. Was there one branch that we could go to that would preach and teach something that really fed our souls? And we didn't even know what that was, because all we had was our fundamental understanding and upbringing, and we really didn't know what we were looking for. So my gender therapist actually worked with a woman there in Kansas City, a psychologist, who happened to be a member of the Community of Christ. And so my gender therapist went, because I was a hard case for her to deal with, I think. She went to the psychologist and she said, "Hey, I've got this person that I'm working with who's a member of the same church you are, or one similar to it. How do I deal with this?" And they want spiritual, they're seeking for spiritual, a spiritual life. Can you help me? Where can they go to find that? And so this person recommended that we attend a congregation in the Kansas City area, in Independence, actually, and it was called the Walnut Gardens Community of Christ. And
so you were still there. You were still in the area, right? Because you said you said Kansas City, but you were still, you still had a fundamentalist kind of perspective for all those years, even when you started working with the gender therapist when you were around 50 years old.
Oh yeah, it was so difficult. It took me probably about 4 years to work through those issues, because I knew that I was going to burn in hell. I knew that I was destined to burn in hell, because I was questioning God and what God had made me. And I'd had it hammered into my head so many times. God doesn't make mistakes. And you cannot say that God made a mistake. And you cannot say that this isn't the way you were created, because this is the way you were created. Come out of your sin and repent. And we, you know, we had elders come to our house when they found out what was going on, and, you know, for, you know, different times. And they would say that exactly. You must repent because your soul is in danger of hellfire. You know, and, my sister told me, one of my sisters told me, that I had sold my soul for a bowl of pottage. You know, going back to that story in the Bible, you know, where Esau gave up his birthright to Jacob for a bowl of soup, you know? And that's the kind of thing we faced. And so Joyce was afraid to go to this Walnut Gardens. And so I went the first Sunday, on my own. And, there was a young guy preaching there. And his name is Greg Mengele. And Greg, stood up and gave a sermon. And one of the things that he said in his sermon was, "One of the things I love about the Community of Christ is that we are open and inclusive, and we accept everyone." And I sat there in my seat in that church, and I said, "Okay, I'm going to put this to the test. You know, this is what you said. I'm coming back again next week." And I went back again next week, and there was a woman in charge, which I had never been to a service where there was a woman in charge, and I didn't know what to expect. But Norma Elgin was in charge, and she talked about, it was a Peace and Justice Sunday, I believe, and she gave people an opportunity. And I was there again with two of my kids, and I said, I stood up, and I didn't want to come out and tell everybody what was going on, because my kids were there with me, and they weren't aware of any of this stuff yet. And I said to the congregation, I said, "I'm about to do something that is going to totally change my life for the rest of my life, and I really need help with this." So I approached the pastor, and, you know, we became members of the congregation at Walnut Gardens, and quite literally, those people saved my life.
Wow.
They saved my life. They took us in. They loved us. They mm-hmm. taught me a different theology than I had ever been exposed to before.
Mm-hmm.
They taught me it's okay to question. It's okay to doubt. It's okay to not understand or not have all of the answers to questions. It's okay to disagree with people and not hate them and turn them away and say you have to be exactly like us and see everything the way we see it. Otherwise, you can't be a part of our group. These people lived what I felt was the kingdom. And mm-hmm. for the first time in my life, I felt like I was being fed spiritually and wow. that I was in a place where I was loved and cared for, and I knew I was valued. And so Joyce started coming with me, and she immediately felt the same thing. Mm-hmm. And we brought our kids with us. But one of the things I want to share with you so you yeah. understand as well is sure. that we had raised our kids in a very fundamental home.
Yeah.
We told them what we thought was right and wrong. We pounded scriptures into their head. We told them how they needed to think about them and how to see them. And that if they ever questioned, you know, it was not of God and that they were, you know, their faith was in question and all of that kind of thing. We thought we were doing what was right.
Yeah.
And by the time we got them to the Community of Christ Church, much of the damage, I think, and I think Joyce does too, had already been done. You know, we mourn. We really do mourn that we raised our kids in that environment. And we pray for our kids every day, you know, mm-hmm. and I don't know what else to do at this point, you know, other than to hope that someday they'll be able to see and understand that the theology they were taught as kids was totally wrong and totally off base and totally skewed. And so I began to see my fundamentalism in a whole new light. I saw it more as a sickness, really, than anything else, you know, a fear that, sure. you know, I had to have everything in such a tight little controlled box
mm-hmm.
to see everything in just a certain way. Otherwise it would all fall apart. And that's exactly what happened when the church began to ordain women into the
right.
priesthood. My world, that box just started to disintegrate and I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Yeah.
And so, you know.
That makes, that makes total sense. So it sounds like, you know, you were seeing the gender therapist and your therapist connected you to this congregation and that welcomed you with open arms. And it sounds like they kind of gave you the courage in addition to Joyce also being on board to be able to transition. Share a little bit about making that decision. And then if you, to the extent that you can or want to, and if not, we can, you know, we don't need to go there, but talk a little bit about, you know, breaking it to your children and sort of what their response had been.
Okay. Or what. Okay. Well, I had been going to the gender therapist, oftentimes, with Joyce, for a period of about 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, she had worked with us very intensely, often on a weekly basis, to help support me through this stuff. And, I don't know how to put it into words.
Uh-huh.
The fundamentalist, teachings and ideas and thoughts were so deeply ingrained in my soul.
Yep.
That, dealing with them and even bringing stuff to the surface, you know, and questioning took months and months and months of therapy to even be able to, you know, to even question and talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very, very slow and very painful process. And so one of the things that had really concerned both Joyce and I was that the kids would fall apart when we told them. And
right.
so we worked with the therapist to try to figure out a way to do it so that it wouldn't cause them problems or, minimize it as much as we could.
Right.
And so we came up with a plan, and Joyce and I, we picked a day and we sat all the kids down. And our youngest would have probably been 4 or 5 maybe at the time. Our oldest was still a teenager, I believe, at the time, maybe a little bit older than that. And we just said, hey, this is the deal. You know, I am not a male. I am a female. And I just can't go on living like this anymore. And you're going to see me change in the very near future. And I want you to know that I love you. And, you know, we talked to the kids, and it was like 30 minutes later or an hour later, it was like, okay, can we go play now and do stuff? And it was like they hadn't been fazed by it at all in our home. It was like, and I looked at Joyce like, and we spent 4 years agonizing over this. And,
right.
you know, in a half hour to an hour, it was all done. And everybody
like, can we
was
go to Dairy Queen?
Yeah, let's go. Let's go get some ice cream or something, or go to a movie or something, you know. And, of course, my youngest two girls wanted to go shopping right away and do stuff together. But this is another thing that is important, you know, that I feel really blessed in. You know, probably about 95% of the people who are transsexual, they lose their families.
Right.
Their spouses leave. They take the kids with them. If they're grandkids, those go. They're left with nothing. They lose their jobs. They have no way of making it, making a living, or they have to work in substandard jobs. I know people who were engineers who were, you know, and working at menial jobs, low paying, minimum wage jobs to try to make ends meet, or are forced to go into, the sex trade because they cannot, find a job. I didn't have that. And I'll tell you how that came about here in just a minute. But, at that point I was an RN and, I didn't lose my job. I didn't lose my family, but my kids, and my wife, especially my kids, took a brunt of garbage from people that I wasn't aware of at the time. My restoration pals behind my back came to all my kids and said to my kids, if you want to leave and move out, we'll give you a house to move into. We'll give you a place to stay. If you want to turn your back on your folks, we will provide a place for you to go to. I also was told, Joyce and I were told, that we were unfit to be parents and that our kids should be taken away from us. And of course we lived in a fear of that for a long time, especially in Missouri, that our kids could be taken from us. My kids went to a restoration school. We had sent them from the time of kindergarten on. We had sent them to a restoration school, which was a private school, which part of their curriculum was the Book of Mormon and the Doctrine and Covenants and the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And they were indoctrinated there as well as at home in the restoration teachings and beliefs.
Right.
And so many, when their friends found out what was going on, many of them turned their backs on my kids.
Mm-hmm.
And would have nothing to do with them. We had one of our boys in Boy Scouts, and when we would go to his recognition ceremonies for badges that he had earned or whatever, he eventually became an Eagle Scout. They would stand on one side of the podium, and Joyce and I and Adam would stand on the other side all by ourselves because they didn't want to be close to us.
Wow.
And the Boy Scout troop was run by a restoration branch.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we were in this thing deep, and we had to get out of it.
Sure.
And so that's, but my kids took a lot of garbage and a lot of, pain because of my decision, you know, to do what I did. And mm-hmm. I am so very thankful that I have the kids that I've got, because they are just totally awesome. You know, they've stood by me, mm-hmm. you know, the whole way.
That was going to be my question. Even though you said earlier that they perhaps still have some fundamentalist ideas and theology that they hold on to, it sounds like they've been supportive of you and have embraced you in your journey.
Well, if that's the way you understood what I said, then I miscommunicated, and let me clarify that for you.
Please, yeah.
My kids don't even believe in God anymore.
I see. Got
Many
it.
Of my kids have no belief system at all anymore.
I see. Got
and
it.
I mean that's what I mean when they. I hope someday they'll, you know, come to a point where they can even believe again. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. So that's the way they've taken it.
Okay. I understand. That makes sense.
At the same time we went to Walnut Gardens, I was working as a nurse at a inner city hospital in Kansas City.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was down in the working, during my last semester of nursing school, I was working as a emergency room technician, and there was a transgender person, a tech, that was working there that I had never seen before.
Hmm.
I think was a new person, and male to female, obviously. And the person went into the men's room to use the bathroom, and the males and several people in the meeting. It was a pre-shift meeting there in the emergency room. Said, "What was that?" And they all started laughing and making jokes about the person that had just gone in the bathroom. And so I said, "Gosh, there's no way I don't want to deal with this. You know, I don't want to deal with this." And so I wrote a letter to the HR people there at the hospital, and I said, "Hey, I've got a friend who's a nurse. This is what happened in the emergency room. This is what I saw. I have a friend who's a male-to-female transsexual who's an RN who would like to work at this hospital but will not put up with that kind of behavior from other people who work here. Mm-hmm. What can you do?" And so the HR lady wrote me back and said, "You need to come talk to me." And so I went up to her office for a meeting and sat down, and she said, "When are you planning on transitioning?" So my ruse.
So you're clever.
You know, try to get by. And, yeah, she just said, "Okay, when are you planning on transitioning?" And she helped me over the next year. We came up with a plan. We worked the plan about 2 or 3 or 4 months before I came out at work. They started having trainings on our unit and other units at the hospital. About how to accept people that are transsexual and gay and lesbian and those kinds of things. And she worked really hard with me to make it a smooth transition.
Mm.
And part of the process of becoming a female, going from male to female, uh-huh. is that you have to live as a female full time for 1 to 2 years in preparation before the therapist will even sign off on the documents that you need to take to the surgeon for the surgery to be done. Because, you know, it's irreversible and they don't want any regret, you know, and that kind of thing. So I would have to work as and live as a female for 2 years prior to my transition, which required that I had to come out at work.
Right.
And so the first night they were all told in an email, "Guy is becoming Gale, and will be coming to work on such and such a date as Gale, and will be accorded, you know, and will be treated accordingly, and this will not have any impact on our operation or patient care," you know, on and on and on, "and you're expected to act professionally," you know, all of those kinds of things. So I come into work, and I worked with a couple of gay guys, gay nurses that were there, And mm-hmm. they came and looked and they said, well, you don't look anything like we thought you would. I said, what did you think I would look like? And I said, did you think I would come in here looking like RuPaul or something? You know? And they just started laughing. And we just had a good time with it. And the funny thing was, for the first time, I had been there almost 3 years.
Yeah.
And for the first time, every unit ran out of pencils that night and had to come to our unit to get pencils. And so people right. would troop through and look, and I would just smile and wave, you know, and it quickly became a nothing issue. I only had a couple of instances where I just had to stand up and say, hey, do you have a problem with this? Because if you have a problem with this, we can go talk to the manager right now, and I think we can resolve this issue rather quickly.
Right.
And they would say, no, I have no problem.
Right.
I'm fine
right.
with it. No problem at all.
Right.
And, but it went really well. And so I have been blessed, with a family that's been supportive. I've never been, economically, hindered by my transition. I work at one of the greatest, hospitals and institutions in the world here at Stanford University. It's never been an issue here, with people in the hospital. Now, sometimes patients.
Sure.
And sometimes others outside of the hospital who are contractors have had issues with it. But, you know, with the people I work with, it's never been an issue.
When did you decide to move from, you know, from the Kansas City area to California?
Well, we've been here since 2011.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from this area. I was born
in... That's right.
Mm-hmm. Martinez, California. I graduated from high school in Novato, California. Joyce is from Fresno. So
mm-hmm.
I miss the ocean. I love the ocean. I love sailing. I love boats. And we wanted to come back and live here. And so in 2011, I applied for a job at Stanford. And I got the job, and we moved out at that point.
Okay, cool. And it sounds like maybe the kids were ready for a fresh start as well, since it sounds like there's
at first, yeah, they didn't want to leave their friends and mm-hmm. and all of that kind of thing back there. But when we ask them now, they're happy that they live here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so you've continued to be involved and active in Community of Christ since your move as well.
Yes, I have. We actually attend two different congregations here.
Mm-hmm.
In the morning, we go to a place called Walnut Creek, because their services are in the morning. And then in the evenings, services are held in San Francisco at the Community of Christ there. And so we go there. So we're real active in church, that way. But with a whole totally different mindset and outlook.
Yeah. Why don't you share a little bit about that? You hinted at it, but why don't you talk a little bit about the content of your faith and how it's changed in terms of what you believe and how you interact with the with God and the spiritual part of your life?
Okay. One of the things I notice in many people who are part of the GLBT community, we have been told forever that we are an abomination in the eyes of God, and that we have only one end, and that end is the, you know, the lake of fire and brimstone, and that God simply does not love people like us. He hates us. So I was convinced for a number of years, which is really hard to explain, since I was so actively involved in the restoration movement, the whole time all this was going on, knowing in my heart that I was going to burn and die, but preaching and teaching about a God who demanded obedience, and that if you obeyed to the right degree, you would be saved into the kingdom, and that every act and every thought and every attitude that you had was somehow weighed in a balance.
Yeah.
And God, on the day of judgment, would take that balance and would somehow decide where you were going to go, whether it was the celestial glory, the terrestrial glory, the telestial glory, to, you know, the prison house, or to the lake of fire and brimstone. And I don't know how I did it. I don't know how I taught and was so zealous and taught about a God like that, especially the way I felt.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that indicates some kind of, you know, just how, deeply the, what's the word I want? The compartmentalization had taken place in my life was so deep and so intense that I could compartmentalize my transsexualism into one area, and I could compartmentalize my faith and my beliefs and all of that into another area, but they were totally separate from each other, and they couldn't mix.
Right.
So, I believe that, and even to the point where we moved out here in 2011, I still had times where I really felt like I was just, you know, there's a scripture someplace that mentions, those that were, created to be burned or something to that effect, you know, vessels of wrath. It uses the word vessels of wrath, created to be destroyed or something like that.
Where is that in the,
that's in the Bible someplace. I'd have to look it up. I don't
know. I'm a bad seminary student. I don't know if it's like that.
Yeah, you should know that, Katie.
I know, right? Oh, here it is. Vessels of wrath fitted to destruction.
Yes.
Romans 9:22.
Yes.
Well, that's a mean one. Okay. You were preaching on that one. You were like, you were the vessel of wrath.
I was the vessel of wrath that was prepared for destruction.
You were made to be destroyed. God made you to destroy.
I was made. Right. Uh-huh. God made some of us to destroy us.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that. And I think that was reinforced through all of this teaching,
right,
you know, about God and God's wrath. And you know, he only shows mercy to those that are, you know, the elect. Now, I don't know if it's this way in the LDS church, but in our LDS church, with the group of people that I knew,
mm-hmm,
we were the one true church upon this whole mm-hmm earth, and there were no right others like us.
Right.
And we had more light than anybody else had, and we were destined, if we lived appropriately and followed the commandments, we were destined for celestial glory.
Mm-hmm.
And all others would be going to some other place. And that's why it was so critical for us to get the story out there and to tell other people about this great gospel.
Right.
So that they wouldn't burn in hell forever and ever. You know, because everybody knows that God's wrath and punishment is endless and eternal. And once you're destined for that place, there ain't no coming out of it, you know? And so that is
wow, that's intense. Oh, sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. I was just saying that was intense. Yeah. Keep going.
That's it. That's it. It's just, and so when we went to Walnut Gardens and started going there, we have a couple of dear friends there. We have a lot of friends there.
Sure.
I have tons of friends at Walnut Gardens that I keep in touch with all the time. There are a couple of people who are like parents to Joyce and I, and their name is Dick and Barbara Howard.
Mm-hmm.
Dick used to be the historian for the Community of Christ Church at one point.
Yeah.
And they put their arms around us, and they loved us, and they began to teach us and show us, more importantly than the teaching part, is we had never been shown what true love was all about, and that God's love is endless. There is no, you know, bottom or top or any kind of dimension to God's love. It's eternal, and it goes on and on and on and on. There's nowhere you can go to hide from God's love. And we began to feel that, being in that place. We began to understand that. We began to see that and experience it. And that's why I say those people saved my life, because they showed me, you know, a totally different way.
Yeah.
And so now when I'm a priest in the community of Christ Church.
Mm-hmm.
So now when I go places and I preach or I teach or I share with people, I tell them about a God that's totally different than the one I grew up with. They don't even, you know, the other one that I grew up with is non-existent, is not there anymore. The God that I worship now is beyond all things and through all things and in all things and is loving and will bend over backwards to do whatever it takes to save even one person. And that's the kind of God I talk about. And I like to work with people that are like me, GLBT folks. I don't know if you knew that or not, but there's a lot of us out here in San Francisco.
Right.
And,
I've heard that.
Yeah, there's a lot of us out here and a lot of them have gone through very similar experiences in other churches. It's not just, not just our church.
No, that's
or the
definitely
old church.
Out there.
Yes.
In
and
the,
I want
to. Christian church in general.
Yeah.
And you're, and so you're able to reach out to, LGBTQ folks, within and without the, you know, beyond the denominational borders of community of Christ.
Is
that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that is exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And I would, you know, if all I did with the rest of my life was work with that group of people,
mm-hmm.
I would feel like my life was fulfilled and had some meaning and purpose. I'd be very happy. I don't think it's going to be just with LGBTQ folk.
Right.
But I think that is a group of people that needs to know that God loves them no matter what.
Yeah.
And I think they need to experience that love. And that's what we try to do at Walnut Creek. And of course at San Francisco at Walnut Creek, those folks are fantastic there too. Mm-hmm. I mean, we accept everybody in. We have everything that you could imagine there, you know?
Yep.
And they love them. We love them and we accept them and we make them part of our group and we involve them. And, you know, it's just a beautiful thing.
Wow. Wow. What a story. Oh my gosh. What a journey you've been on, Gail. I can't even fathom it.
Well, you know, and the other thing, Katie, is this. You'll probably end up having to edit this out, but I want to just tell you something. I mean, I have.
Yeah.
Quite literally had experiences that most people in this world have never had. I mean, I've experienced life in very real ways.
Yeah.
As a male and as a female. And they are totally different. They're totally different, you know, and there aren't too many people that can say that they have experienced, you know, things from both sides and seen both sides. And,
right.
And understand both sides. And it's both confusing and it's very fascinating and very enriching all at the same time.
Huh. Yeah, that is super interesting. And boy, your wife, she sounds amazing. I'd love to maybe get her on sometime and hear her story as well, because I'm sure that was quite a journey for her.
Oh, yeah.
As well. And I'm deeply moved to hear you share about your experiences of acceptance and love and grace from your faith community and from your family, from your work community. You're right that so many of the stories that we hear are so, so heartbreaking and so negative and stories of just utter, you know, loss. And it's beautiful to hear a story from that, of course, incorporates agony and you know the terrible pain that you experienced, but that also then has reconciliation and love winning in the end. And I think that's just I think that's wonderful. And I think, you know, as a minister to be, I hear your story and I just think, if only the whole church could be that way, you know? If only kids didn't grow up thinking that they were broken and worthless and fit for destruction. There's a lot of work to be done in the church, because a lot of times where the families get those ideas comes from the church, you know?
Yeah.
And the ideas of grace and of God's love that is so wide and so deep, putting that front and center in our theology, I think just, it changes the world, doesn't it?
It sure does. I mean, that's one of the things I really love about the community of Christ,
mm-hmm.
is that it's, instead of focusing on a set of doctrines and creeds and beliefs that we're better than everybody else and we're the only true church and all of that, the church, as I understand it and see it and experience it today, is focused on loving people no matter what, and developing relationships with people, and building community, and working and living side by side each other, and walking together through this life, developing a love for each other and a love for God, and a caring, compassion, and active interest in the lives of all people, and wanting to make the world a much better place for everyone. I love the mission of the church, and I love being a part of it. And I still struggle with how could I have ever believed what I believe? But you know, when you're so deeply entrenched in it, and that your whole world is that, especially as a young child,
right?
You don't know any different. You know, I mean, I was told this is what to believe, and I said, okay, you know, and just never questioned it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Wow. Well, Gail, thank you so much for coming on to Project Zion. It has been a pleasure, and you can't see me because we're not video chatting, but I was like wiping tears away through your entire story, and I'm sure I'm sure there's not... I can't imagine that anyone could hear your story and not be just profoundly moved. I'm sure there will be not a dry eye in the cars or the bike paths or wherever folks are listening to you share your experience. We're just deeply grateful to you, and it's been an absolute honor to have you on. Thank you so much for being with us.
I am so thankful to have been asked to do this. And one of the reasons why I am so very grateful is I want to be able to be open and vulnerable. I want people to know that there are people like me out here.
Mm-hmm.
And that if they need to talk to somebody or need to be supported, that there are people like me that are here that would love to befriend them and to talk to them, you know, and to be with them on their walk. I don't want to see anybody do anything that would be harmful to themselves because of the lies that they've been taught and they've learned as children. So for that reason, if for nothing else, I want to thank you very, very much for giving me this opportunity to share my story, because that's all I want to do, Katie. That's all I want to do from now on. I want to share my story. I want to tell people about Jesus. I want to show his love. He saved my life. He loves me with all of his heart. I can't thank him enough for the things that he's done for me. And I just love him with everything. And I want my life to have meaning and purpose and to share that love with other people, because for me, it's the most beautiful thing in the whole world. So thank you very, very much for this time.
Thank you, Gail. It's been an honor.
Project Zion is sponsored by the Latter-day Seekers team from Community of Christ. The views expressed in this episode are of those speaking and do not necessarily reflect the official views of the Latter-day Seekers team or of Community of Christ.